This is Mark Lane.
This is Robert Groden.
This is Dick Russell.
This is Jim Mars.
This is Lisa Pease.
This is Dr. David Mantic.
This is Cyril Weck.
This is Jim DiEugenio.
This is Joan Mellon.
This is David Lifton.
This is Jerry Polycott.
This is Gary Shaw.
This is Bill Kelly.
This is Greg Burnham.
This is Gerald McKnight.
This is Sherry Feaster.
This is Joseph McBride.
This is Bill Davey.
This is Dave Ratcliffe.
This is David Talbot.
This is Doug Horn.
This is Walt Brown.
This is John Barber.
This is Judge Joe Brown.
This is Vince Palomera.
This is Bill Pepper.
This is Richard Belzer.
This is Oliver Stone.
This is Governor Jesse Ventura, and you're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds. T-minus 25 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2,
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we're joined by Rob Couteau and Bobby Marks. Welcome, both of you.
Good to be back, Len.
It is a pleasure to speak to you both. We are talking about the book today by Stanley J. Marks, Murder Most Foul, and other books that have come to light that I didn't know about. I hope that I learn and the audience learns a lot more about it. That's why we have his daughter on, and Rob is publishing the book and I guess a caretaker to this archive by rekindling it. So the idea of this book, Murder Most Foul, came to my attention when Bob Dylan had that great song, Murder Most Foul, in which he started talking about the Kennedy assassination in detail that someone I knew the topic for so many years, 20 years anyway, intimately. And yet I was learning things, and he, in his great grasp of language, just cut right to the quick in so many things. I went, oh my God. Well, we did talk with Rob just about how he got that book. So now it has been scanned, and it has been republished. And also there are it's, I guess with the blessing of Bobby, photos, letters, just things talking about her father. It's just so much about this man that I hadn't known it all, and it's really worth digging into. So I did mention to Rob that I had done a series called 50 Reasons for 50 Years, which I tried to put out 50 tidbits for people who are, you know, have short attention span, and then just they want to know something about the assassination. And here are 50 tidbits in a quick 3 to 5 minute clip. Well, to my surprise, when I went through this book, there's, I believe, 975 questions and answers that are so ahead of their time that what I'm able to put my feet on the ground and understand as what really happened 50, 55 years later, longer, from 63. Back in 1967, Stan Marks had been discussing this. And this book is just, I hate to say it's when I have someone on, it's a must read, but you have to get this book. It's just unbelievable on how you can see where Bob Dylan got his knowledge from, because Bob Dylan had the song of the same title, Murder Most Foul, and it's really impressive. So that's just my little background. Rob, do you want to start off with any which way you'd like the interview to go?
Sure, Len. And you mentioned the other day when you were reading Stan's Murder Most Foul, you felt it was if, you know, you were getting pummeled by
pummeled.
All these questions.
So I know that I had tried 50 reasons that I was thinking, well, you know, can I really get 50? You know, maybe if I stretch it, would I get 100? Here is right. 975 is approximately, that's the right count, right? So
right, I'm glad you said that approximately, because when we spoke the other day, you asked me, you noticed that, you know, poor Stan, he wrote without a professional editor, he self-published, but plus, and Bobby can talk about this, you know, he was making a living as business consultant all at the same time. So, you know, there is little typos and errors in this in the book, not of any importance, but the numbers aren't completely accurately tabulated. So Glenn asked me yesterday, well, exactly how many were there? That got me curious. And I went back and counted, Len. And it's actually 979 total.
Oh, even more than I thought.
Did you know that, Bobby, that, you know, the numbers are a little off, you know?
I never paid attention to it, but I'm right. looking. I have the book in my hand now, and I'm looking. But you did the actual count, so I'm trusting you on that one, Rob.
Right. Right.
So, Bobby, I have a quick question for you. Have you heard the song by Bob Dylan with the same name?
Actually, I have not.
Oh my goodness!
I am not particularly a huge fan of Bob Dylan. Of course, I know who he is. But I've never followed his work very closely. And, you know, when his song came out and prompted all this publicity, I mean, the tie-in, this is the first thing. So I've seen some of the words of the song published, but I've never heard the words put to the music.
Well, I urge you, right after the interview, you have to go listen to it, okay? You have to listen to
okay.
it. Okay. And you know, I'm not a big fan of Bob Dylan. I admired him, and I understood that a lot of people I knew really respected him, if not worshipped him. And when I, you know, heard him, I thought, well, what's the big deal? But every now and then, there would be a song or a topic, Hurricane Carter or whatever, you know, some of these things that went well, good on him. About a couple of years ago, I actually went to see a concert of him, and I was bored to tears. It was, I can't tell you that.
Oh, that's interesting, Len. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like 3 hours of to me, right? And, you know, I know music, but it seemed like it was something, I think even the sound man they got from the 70s, it just sounded old, right? So anyway, when I heard this song, it's jaw-dropping. And then I realized that, well, I don't know much about him, but here on a topic that he talks about, I can see why he won awards in that. I mean, he really... See, I know this topic well, and I know what a tribute or something should be treated to the assassination of John Kennedy. Well, we'll leave it at that for now, but I mean, he has my respect. And let me ask you this, Bobby. Did you know, growing up in the family, talking over dinner and that your father thought something was really wrong with the JFK assassination, the murder of John Kennedy?
Oh, yes. I mean... Absolutely. You know, absolutely. I think he knew that really early on, you know, early on. And my father was a great one to delve into, you know, facts and read things and see. So the book came out in, what, 67, and Kennedy was killed in 63.
Right.
I think early on, my dad thought that something smelled way off.
Right.
You know,
and Bobby, you shared with me also his initial reaction about how sad and depressed he was, and everyone was that you knew at that time.
It was a horrible time. Kennedy was killed, and I had just moved from Chicago to try and get into my profession here in California. I came here in September of 63. The end of September, I believe it was, and Kennedy was killed at the end of November. And my father, I mean, everybody was just, well, you know, you can imagine. And my father was here on a business trip, I believe, soon after that. And he was so depressed. He was so depressed. So I don't know if that was really the start of when he wanted to do the book. You know, my father had written previously, And if it was the assassination that just, you know, made him go sit down and write again, because there was a long period of time between his first book, The Bear That Walks Like a Man, and then Murder Most Foul, there were many years when he didn't write.
Right.
He didn't write. And then all of a sudden, this happened. And then he started writing from this point on, from 1967 on.
And he was knocking them off, like, every couple of years. I mean, like, we've tracked down, we don't even know if we have the complete oeuvre of his work, but we've tracked down, I thought it was 19, we just realized it's 20 books on politics and history.
20-something, I think.
And then Bobby said there's an additional 4 on business and marketing, which are also very good. And part of that 20 books, when I'm saying history and politics, some of them, the book titles, you know, are about religious secular history, but when you open the book, they're just as political as Murder Most Foul. So this guy was incredibly political.
Excuse me a minute, I mean to interrupt, but the interesting thing about it is that most people, maybe in discovering my father, think that he was a full-time author, but as you mentioned earlier, Rob, that wasn't his thing. He was a salesman. That's how he earned his living. He was a really top-flight salesperson. So you have to understand that this man worked a full-time job and then came home on the evenings and on weekends and did all his research and wrote in all the off hours that he wasn't working, which is pretty phenomenal.
It's amazing. Yeah, you know, the French have an expression for this, en marge, which means in the margin. You're creating on your spare time. And Len, he did this with, he typed with 2 fingers on an Underwood manual typewriter. But at rapid speed, right, Bobby?
Yes, he was very fast, extremely fast. You know,
Bobby, this might be a great place to tell Len, when I asked you, what did your father do for fun when he wasn't deeply embroiled in conspiracy research?
Well, the earliest pictures of my dad, and this was so typical, if I think back upon him, this is it. When we were in Chicago, there was a little room off our kitchen area that he converted to his den. And a very typical, now this was before he was doing a lot of the writing, obviously. He didn't really start doing the writing until he moved to Los Angeles. He would come home to relax, and there was a television in the room, and he was a big sports fan. So he would put on whatever game, you know, it could be the White Sox baseball. So we'd have a game, or he'd have boxing on. He'd like boxing. And then he had a comfortable chair with a table next to it. And on that table was a radio. He would have the radio on with another sports event. And then in his lap, he would have, you know, an 800-page nonfiction book that he was reading. He would have a cigar. My cousin reminded me of this. He smoked cigars. So he would have a cigar going someplace or another. And then I always have this recollection that I was in school at the time. If I had a question on history, he was brilliant at history. I would come in the middle of all this. He would stop what he was doing, explain the fact of history. I would leave the room, and he would go back to being very happy with all this commotion, all his newspapers, books, radio and television going on, and he could tell you what was going on in, you know, on the television, in the book, and on the radio.
Now, I have a couple of quick questions for background for people who don't know anything about him.
Right.
Where was he born?
He was born in 1914, in I think in a suburb of Chicago, and I Rob has written about this. My father was left an orphan. His parents died in the big influenza of 1918. And he was taken in, I actually don't know when or at what age he was taken in by
I think it was when he was four, Bobby. when he was 4 years old.
Okay, yeah, I think
that would be 1980.
He was around 4 years of age, and he was taken in by a family in Chicago, and he was, to the best of my knowledge, he was not adopted by this family. He was taken in as a foster child, and he did take their name, which was Markowitz. So he was known as Stanley Markowitz. And he spent all his, you know, all his growing up years with this family. I would like to be able to tell you more about the family. I really don't know that much about them.
That's fine, but from
up,
Chicago.
Mother, yeah.
You know, one thing we do know from the research I did on Ancestry.com, this was a poor family. The father was a tinsmith. They essentially lived in a Russian Jewish ghetto in Chicago. So this is a very poor family, an uneducated family. We don't know how Stanley, you know, could have been mentored intellectually, but somehow he went to Chicago's only public law school. First he graduated from University of Chicago, one of the Chicago universities, with a history degree. Then he graduated from Chicago's only public law school as a lawyer toward the end of the Great Depression. And probably because there were so few jobs, even for lawyers, he worked as a salesman for a billboard company.
Right. And where were you born, Bobby?
I was born in Chicago, Illinois.
Great. So that's where your childhood, your dad did a lot of writing. And you say that he really was politically aware. Yeah, your early memories are he was really taken back by the JFK assassination. Rob, do you want to just give us a little background of his writing? I think it would have started, you mentioned, in the military.
Yes, actually before the military, because, and this is one of the most incredible stories about this guy, while he was a salesman for this billboard company, it was a company that made signs for businesses. Again, as Bobby said, on his spare time, five nights a week, for I think about 4 years, he researched this book, which would later be published as The Bear That Walks Like a Man. It was published in 1943. The book contract was signed September 11th, 1942. So this book was a book about, the subtitle is A Diplomatic and Military Analysis of Soviet Russia. So, you know, it's quite possible Stanley's actual parents were Russian and part of that same neighborhood. His foster parents were Russian. And Bobby, your mother's...
Well, my mother's mother was from Russia.
Right. And Stan had a lively connection with her, right?
Yes.
Right. So, you know, Russia was very much in his personal background. And anyway, he wrote this book about the Soviet Union while they were our ally during World War II. And this book was essentially self-published because it was picked up by a vanity press. In other words, a publisher that normally you would pay the publisher to publish your book, and then the books would get delivered to your house, and there'd be no publicity, and you'd end up giving them away to friends. And, you know, this is what a lot of amateur writers would turn to back in the days before self-publishing software and distribution channels on Amazon, for example. Well, not only, and we found this out, by the way, because Bobby found the contract in a box that was stored in her garage while I was doing this research. Not only was this book, not only did Stanley not have to pay for the publication of this book, but this book became a national bestseller, which enabled him to buy what he called a nice house, okay? This book got published, book reviews of this book got published in over 30 mainstream newspapers in America, almost all of them glowingly positive. And the kicker is, it turns out that while he was doing research for this book, Cordell Hull, who was United States' longest serving Secretary of State under FDR, gave Stanley J. Marks access to State Department files to research this book. And when the book reviews came out, one of the leading Chicago papers published a review by John Cudahy, who was FDR's former ambassador to Belgium and Poland, and also did a lot of other very important work. He was commissioned by, I believe, Life or Look magazine to interview Hitler. This guy was a Harvard graduate with amazing credentials, also an author of several books about Russia himself. So he wrote this glowing review about Stanley's book, and it became a national bestseller. Fast forward a bit to the growing right wing in the United States. Later on, that same newspaper in the 40s, later 40s, published a piece, basically a red baiting piece, about one of the schools that Stanley taught at, and every teacher in that school was blacklisted, including Stanley. So he was essentially blacklisted. And in the House Un-American Activities report that was published that named names, Stanley appears in 3 pages on that report, and they specifically mention that he wrote this pro-Soviet book. Again, this was our ally. They lost millions of lives fighting the Nazis, and he was one of the reasons that Stanley was blacklisted. So I say that, you know, this gentleman led a Zelig-like life. He always seemed to be at crucial times and places in history, in 20th century history. He just led, even if he never wrote anything about JFK, the rest of his life is equally fascinating. And Bobby, you didn't ever know that your father had been blacklisted, correct?
I never knew any of this. I never knew he taught at this school. I never knew he was blacklisted. I never knew any of it. You discovered all of this. It was just news to me, you know, when you told me about it. It was never talked about. I have no idea if my parents were trying to protect me. I grew up in Chicago in what we called a two flat. So we had the upstairs apartment, and my aunt and uncle and cousins lived downstairs. And I'm close to my one cousin, and I asked her if she ever heard her mother and father talking about this. She didn't know any of this either, not a word. Completely new to us, you know, all of this that you discovered, Rob.
Yeah, it's just an amazing story. It's almost like he led a secret life. You know, Dave Nesbitt, who helps Jim DiEugenio edit and webmaster the Kennedys and King website. The last time I was on the show, I had briefly mentioned Stan's work at the Abraham Lincoln School. We never got around to completing that discussion. So he asked me today if we could talk a little bit more about it. That might be a good place for me to just say a couple more things about it.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, it was called the Abraham Lincoln School for Social Science. So again, the book contract got signed in 42. The book reviews started coming out in February, March of 43. Around the same time, this school opened in the spring of 43, while Stan was receiving all those glowing reviews. It was founded by a man, a very important man named William Patterson, an African-American civil rights activist. And it was, you know, they were inviting workers, writers, assisting black immigration from the rural South to the North. And so that was the students that they were aiming for. It only operated full time for 3 years. And what, you know, as the country started moving more towards the right and these articles appeared about the school and blacklisting the teachers there, it was forced to close down. It was one of the first schools to offer a jazz history course, and very important artists and writers such as Howard Fast, who wrote Spartacus, who was also blacklisted and had to self-publish that book, the incredible man Paul Robeson, they both lent their support to the school. And Chicago-based authors such as Nelson Algren, the great black American novelist Richard Wright, who was close friend with James Baldwin, they were both invited to lecture there. And the school was academically supported by liberal educators and financially supported by liberal FDR philanthropists. And they actually conducted lectures in factories where the students worked. I thought that's just such an amazing detail. Of course, the school ended up being surveilled by not only the FBI, but also the National Security Agency, the NSA. I found an actual NSA memo talking about keeping an eye on the school. As I said before, the faculty were later listed in the House on American Activities Committee reports, which, by the way, are as thick as a Bible. I sent one to Bobby in 1944 and 1948. They included, the 48 report included an entire chapter on this school. And in 1950, Billboard magazine, the same magazine that still exists today, they suddenly started publishing a flurry of articles on the so-called red threat. And one of them listed the school as an organization that appeared to be an adjunct of the Communist Party. So again, you know, everyone who's progressive is called a communist. And the Chicago Tribune in October of 43, so that's the, again, 1943, that's the big year for Stanley, because his book comes out in February of 43. He gets a glowing review by John Cudahy, FDR's former ambassador, in the Chicago Tribune. By October of 43, the same paper runs a story called Red Teachers on Faculty at Lincoln School, and it's specifically called Stanley, author of the radical book, The Bear That Walks Like a Man. So 7 months later, they did an about-face. And I think, again, as is the Zelig-like thing, I think all this shows in a microcosm what was happening in the country. You know, this extreme shift to the era of McCarthyism.
Yeah, when you say that, it reminds me of Trump-like right wing of just...
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, to go back to what you asked me about, Len, you know, that was his first book,
right?
The Bear That Walks Like a Man. And by the way, because in the acknowledgement page of that book, he mentions by their actual names his daughter and his wife, only because of that was I able to track down Bobby Marks. Because in Murder Most Foul, he refers to them with their nicknames. Maybe he wanted to keep them safe. But in this book, he mentions them by name. And so I went on Ancestry.com and I created a tree. And that's how I eventually found Bobby.
And what were the nicknames? I missed that.
Butch and Corky.
Oh, okay.
Bobby, you were Corky, right?
I was Corky and my mother was Butch.
And you don't remember why, right? You have no idea why.
I have no idea where the name sprung from. You know, I have no idea, but he would do that in talking. I mean, he called me, he was allowed to call me Roberta, but he did refer to me as Bobby, but there were many times when he would use the term Corky, and I have no idea why.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you can just give another list of some of these books, because you mentioned there's 20 of them, and just kind of briefly touch on
I'll
a few of them.
I'll quickly go through them. So, the second book, also a very interesting story, it was titled History of the U.S. Army and Military Science. It's estimated that this book was somewhere around 750 manuscript pages. It also appears to have been commissioned by the U.S. Army, because by 1945, Stanley was a private in the Army, and a half dozen articles about him appeared in April in Texas newspapers, basically all of them talking about how he's writing this book and how he knows more about military science than his superiors. And again, it said that, you know, the Army and the State Department were helping him get access to information to write this book. And by the way, this book is not just a history of U.S. Army. This book apparently is a history of military science that goes all the way back. And years later, Stanley would write another book called Through Distorted Mirrors. This came out in 1972. And I think that this was possibly spun out of some of the same research material that he did on his second book on military science. It's called Through Distorted Mirrors, and it's a book about... You know, on the surface, it's about monotheism and world civilization, but it's also very political. And among other things, it contains a very lengthy, in-depth treatment on ancient Jewish military history, going all the way back to the Old Testament. And Bobby has a friend who's essentially a scholar of Jewish religion and culture, very critical of, you know, what makes a good book and a bad book, okay? And he's currently reading this book. He's enthralled by it, and he's absolutely shocked at the depth of Stanley's knowledge on this subject. Again, I think that was a big surprise to you, Bobby, right?
I'm surprised, too, because we were a secular family and there was no religion in the home. And I just never knew where this came from. You know, I just never knew where it came from. Mm. So it was actually really a shock to me.
And then the fourth book, so Murder Most Foul actually is his third book. And that's September 1967. So he writes four in-depth books on the JFK assassination and on the other assassinations. The next one, which we've just published, and it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Nobles and all around the world, it's called 2 Days of Infamy, November 22nd, 1963, September 28th, 1964. The latter date, of course, is the date that the Warren Commission published its so-called report. I think it's a great title. And he subtitles it, A Textbook for Government Agents, Lawyers, Professionals, and Students Analyzing the Methods of the Warren Commission. And by the way, that in that book, published in March of 69, he's already talking about how the murders of, he's already using the term conspirators when referring to the assassins of John and Bobby Kennedy and of Martin Luther King. And he states unequivocally, quote, all three were murdered as the end result of three interrelated conspiracies, adding history has shown that an invisible coup d'etat occurred when President Kennedy was murdered. So he was way ahead of the time in connecting those three events. And this is why the author Joachim Josten, who wrote that great early book, Oswald Assassin or Fall Guy, in his newsletter, which was published in 1972, Josten says, to my knowledge, nobody but Jim Garrison and an obscure West Coast writer named Stanley J. Marks has ever endorsed before my unswerving contention that the murder of John F. Kennedy was nothing short of a camouflaged coup d'etat. So I think that's, you know, that's one of the big reasons that we all feel that Stanley was, as Jim DeGenio said, rocket miles ahead of many other researchers. So that's...
Was he living in Chicago the whole time?
No, he moved to L.A. We recently found an application for a patent... It was a notarized application for a business, to create a new business in L.A. that dates from October of 64. And Bobby remembers him being there around the end of 1964.
My parents moved to Los Angeles a year after I had come to Los Angeles.
They wanted to be near you, Bobby, right? That was the main reason.
Yes. I had told them that I was my career was probably going to be in Los Angeles. There was nothing for me in Chicago, and so I wasn't moving back home. And when I was a teenager, my dad had an opportunity to move to California, and they put it on hold because I think I was entering, or I was in high school at the time, and they felt it wouldn't be a good time to uproot me. So when I decided that I wasn't going to go back to Chicago, they decided that they would move to Los Angeles.
And Stanley stayed in that location until he died in 1999. He really hunkered down there. After 2 Days of Infamy in February of 1970, he published his third JFK book called Coup d'etat, Three Murders That Changed the Course of History, President Kennedy, Reverend King, Senator R.F. Kennedy. And then, Len, you know, we haven't talked about this before, but this is another exciting development. Stanley wrote in late 1970, he wrote a three-act play about the three murders of JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King. And it was originally copyrighted a play of on I think only about the John F. Kennedy assassination. That was copywritten in February of 68 and was called Murder Most Foul. A subtitle, a three-act play that reveals how a chief of state was assassinated. But then later on, he expanded it into this piece called A Time to Die, A Time to Cry. And it's a play about all three assassinations. And the only place, the only reason I know about this is that there was I think it was called The Assassination Pleas Almanac or something. It was a collection of all the books that had been written up to that point. And it's mentioned in that book. And it, all it says is, you know, performance unknown. Okay. So I knew it existed. And so I went into the copyright office online. And long story short, they have it. They have the original copy. And so we're negotiating to get a copy of that play. And wouldn't that be something if we can get that play? Yeah. That's certainly the, you know, even in that book, The Assassination Pleas Almanac, there's maybe, you know, seven or eight other plays mentioned. None of them deal with all three assassinations. So that's got to be the first time anybody ever did that. Okay. And then, then there's other books about, you know, there's a book which is an attack on the Nixon administration that came out in 1971, Watch What We Do, Not What We Say. And there are some very good vitriolic attacks against President Reagan. And he continued to publish all the way until 3 years before he died. Actually, 2 years before he died, because the last book he came out with was 1997, and he died in 1999. So this guy was just incredibly prolific. And as Bobby said, he's running businesses at the same time. Bobby, maybe you could mention how they would hire him to come in and restructure everything, and then he did such a good job. What would happen?
Yeah, it was my dad was obviously he was a very good salesperson, and he was an incredible marketing person. So a company would hire him, and you know, most people would string it out so that they would have a job. My father would go in and redo their marketing plan in 2 weeks, and they'd go, "Thanks, Stan," and then he'd get fired. You know, it used to drive us crazy because this man had a million jobs a year, but he was just brilliant, and he just moved quickly, and he just wanted to get things, you know, straightened out, and he did it, but he did it so well that they didn't need him anymore, which didn't please my mother too much, you know, as he was always looking for work, always. He always found it. He was very good at finding a job, but it could be very tense when he didn't have the job, you know, when there was no money coming in for a while. So that was kind of scary. But he was a brilliant marketing guy, absolutely brilliant on it.
Didn't you tell me, Bobby, that if you had copies of all his W-2 forms, they would fill up like a thick binder?
And I take after my dad. I have that same kind of work history. So, yeah, we could fill up an office with our forms. Just amazing.
You know, Len, one of the amazing things about Murder Most Foul, I think, is that it's almost present. You know, it's obviously he's presenting it as a prosecutor, as if he's prosecuting the Warren Commission. So all these rhetorical Q&As. But there's also a real feeling of unraveling a murder mystery, like a detective story. In his second book on the assassination, 2 Days of Infamy, I just wanted to read this little couple of sentences. He says, "A true addict of the art of detection is always fascinated by the method used by writers of detective novels to tie in the threads of their murder story. A true addict can always spot where the thread breaks, and a good writer never permits that thread to break prior to the solution given to the reader. The Oswald Tippit Warren Commission affair was a detective story where the thread broke and the solution offered was falsified." Bobby, maybe you could talk about Stanley's love of detective stories and how he took you to the library when you were just a very, very little girl.
Yeah, he read nonfiction. You know, that was the heavy duty stuff. But to relax, he read mysteries, intrigue. He loved it, and his love of it was passed down to me. So growing up, we always had, you know, for quick reads, the Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock anthologies that, you know, you could pick up and read a story in 5 minutes and whatever. And then he would go and read, you know, some of the top people. I'm sitting in our den area right now, and I'm looking at, you know, Rex Stout and Dashiell Hammett. And, you know, just the top writers of his time, he read everything. He just read everything as far as mysteries go. And his love of that was transferred to me. I'm a great fan of the mystery book.
We mentioned that you are both from Chicago, then living in L.A. And one little piece of serendipity is that Bob showed me a L.A. Free Press review of one of his books. And then right across from it is the Bob Dylan ad for his upcoming conference. And you have to think, oh, let's check out our ad in the LA Free Press. And, you know, most likely, or we're, you know, considering that Bob Dylan was looking at his ad and noticed this also review of the book. And that's,
I know.
Go ahead.
Isn't that interesting that the ad appeared, the both ads appeared across from other on this in the same paper?
It's very suggestive, I think, you know.
Because I couldn't believe how much Bob Dylan knew about the assassination. And it seemed that it was, you know, I've never heard him talk about it. He's talked about other social issues and that, but I didn't think it was even on his radar. And then for his song to just be so, I mean, that was the one thing I was asking. How does he know so much about the topic? What did he read that I didn't read, you know?
I think the ad we're referring to was actually a ad for Pennebroke's film Don't Look Back. Is that the title? I don't know if I'm screwing that up, but it's the film about Dylan, right?
Oh, I thought it was a concert.
I thought it was a concert too, Rob.
Oh, maybe it was. Okay.
The Troubadour. Dylan was appearing at the Troubadour here in Los Angeles.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. One of the
But for those who haven't seen it, it's like there's a big article about, you know, the murder of JFK, and a good half of this piece is quoting from Stanley's third JFK book, Coup d'etat, and right under the end of that article there's a nice big ad on that Dylan thing. So it's like when I saw that, I was like, this is almost like a hermetic code for what's going to happen decades later. Dylan is somehow going to see the title of this book or read this book, and it's going to trigger some creative response. And, you know, I also want to give a shout out to my friend Jim Lampos, who, besides being a very talented musician and Dylan scholar, he's, you know, Jim is a local historian. So I relied heavily on him for his ideas about, you know, how and why Dylan might have picked up on on the book Murder Most Foul. And Jim said that Dylan is known to spend hours and hours alone in libraries, looking at microfilm, looking at old newspapers, and he actually collects, you know, buys and collects a lot of old newspapers and books from this period. And the Los Angeles Free Press and the Berkeley Barb were really the two leading underground papers at that time. And not only did that Dylan ad appear under that article about coup d'etat, but Stanley put many ads for Murder Most Foul in the Los Angeles Free Press, as well as the Berkeley Barb, you know, and one of them, there was also an ad for his book, 2 Days of Infamy. And underneath the ad, it says, you know, you can acquire this in bookstores with courage. That must have been Stanley writing that, right? Right, Bobby?
Yes.
Great sales.
Absolutely. Doesn't it sound like him? Absolutely.
Right.
You know, there was another one, I think it was something like, look, Europe is reading this book, America, you know, take notice.
Right.
With exclamation points. Are there exclamation points?
Bobby, tell everyone about how your husband couldn't handle one more exclamation mark. I thought that was funny.
Oh yeah, I don't know exactly what you're referring to on that, Rob, but
trying
to read my dad's books. I mean, you had to get through, like, at the end of the sentence, there were like 5 exclamation points. Everything was exclamation. You know, it used to drive my husband crazy.
Didn't John say something like, if I see one more exclamation, I'm throwing the book out the window or something like that?
Probably. And he probably would have done it too.
You know, it's funny because you bring up the exclamation marks. I remember reading a few years ago, there was a literary critic that was talking about Graham Greene, the novelist Graham Greene, who was also very, very political and had a great deal of outrage at, you know, the way unempowered people are treated in the world. And he was quoting this other critic who was making fun of Graham Greene because he used too many italics or too many exclamation marks. And the second critic was saying, well, you know, this was all he had because he had such outrage at the horrors in the world, at the way people, the poor people are treated, at the way that these imperialistic powers treat these people. That's all he had. And I thought of that when I read your father's books, I think of that, you know. He uses these exclamation marks a lot. He also uses polemic and a kind of sardonic sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But those are the only tools a writer has. He doesn't have guns, you know.
Well, that's true. And my father was outraged by so many things happening in the world. So I guess the exclamation points did work. Mm. To show
what do you think your father would, how do you think Stan would react today during the last 4 years with this dictator?
He would have been crazy.
He would have been apoplectic.
He would have been so distressed, so angry, so furious at what is going on today, at this government, this corrupt government. I mean, I think he would have lost his mind. And in many ways, I'm really glad that both my parents are gone and they didn't have to live through these past few, 4 years that we've had here. I just can't even imagine their outrage. Mm. It would have been intolerable, mm. You know. And my dad, the thing is that my dad early on predicted a lot of this. Mm-hmm. That's what's so frightening to me, mm. is that, you know, he writes about, you know, a moral compass. When the country loses its moral compass, mm. well, where are we, folks? You know, the past 4 years would have been just, they wouldn't have tolerated it. It would have been impossible.
Mm. Well said, Bob. Mm.
When did your father pass away?
In 1999.
Because I thought, after reading some of what he had, I thought he would have had a field day with 9/11 and just writing anomalies, the things that had happened in that, and all the news, the reporting, and Iraq war and things like that. So I could just see him.
He would have. I mean, there would have been a lot for him to say, and he was never at a shortage for words. there was never a quiet space when my father was around. You would have heard plenty on anything that you want to, you know, anything that has happened from 2000 to 2020. He would have had lots to say.
Bobby, did he subscribe to many, many different magazines and newspapers, or did he go to the library to get that, or what?
You know, I think it was a combination of both. My father was a library man. Mm. We all had library cards. We went at least once a week to the library. I think when he was younger and maybe didn't have that much money, he had to depend on the library, you know, more. But in later life, he did subscribe to a lot of publications. We had, like I said, that back room that was his den was filled with, you know, with books and newspapers and magazines and you couldn't even walk in there. So yes, he did get a lot of that, but he was a great fan of the public library system.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like Glenn, you mentioned this the other day, the diverse sources of information that Stanley uses to cobble these books together is really mind-blowing. And I wonder how he ever found out about half this stuff. For example, I'm holding in my hand right now an October 1964 copy of a magazine called Mechanics Illustrated. And he mentions this in Murder, Most Foul in the context of how the Italian Carcano rifle that supposedly killed JFK was really a shoddy piece of workmanship. So I go on eBay a few weeks ago. I find a copy of this for sale. I order the copy. Well, sure enough, on page 91, so it's this article called Big Bargains in Rifles. And I never saw this term before, sporterized rifles. So apparently you could buy these old military rifles and sporterize them, you know, convert them into hunting rifles. And so it's a review of a number of different rifles. And on page 91, there's there's a subheading, Poor Rifle Conversions. The Mannlicher Caucano Italian top left is crudely made, poorly designed, dangerous, and inaccurate. And it's basically, the writer literally says, you get what you pay for, you know? And somehow Stanley found this. You know, what was he doing reading Mechanics Illustrated? You know, I don't know. I don't know how he found it, you know?
It's astounding. Now, getting back to the book, is there one or two things that Bobby or Rob, you would like to bring up that are an item from the book that is really worthwhile mentioning? I know there's so many. There's just so many. But every now and then I stumbled onto, three or four questions, a little theme of something that really I thought, my God, he's right to the crux of the whole matter. And it would be like a rhetorical question, you know, did the Warren Commission sequester the real, x-rays or whatever? Do they just rely on, hearsay or something like that? Do you have anything you'd like to just bring out? Because I'm really trying to get people's attention to this book that
sure. Thank you for asking that, Len. That's a good idea to give people an idea of the actual writing. Well, as I said the last time we spoke, I think, one of the most significant lines in Murder, Most Foul, and I happened to open to this line when I first looked at the book, carefully. Now, again, keep in mind, this is September 1967. He says that the CIA controls many of the news columns in both the press and magazines is now known. What is not known and what will never be known is how many agents of the CIA now work for various organs in the mass communication media. You know, there weren't a lot of people thinking about that in 1967. And then if you fast forward to today, back then there was a very well-organized program that the CIA had to secretly insert journalists into major media. And that was called sheep dipping. But now, when you watch CNN or even MSNBC, they're proud to tell you that they're so-called former intel operators, right?
Or that if they're talking about the military, they're embedded.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That benign term, embedded in the military,
Instead of going there independently to report on what they're witnessing, they're there to be presented. Here's what you will tell your viewers.
Exactly. Another thing about Stan is that he was very good at absorbing all the current research and contemporary authors back then, but he would take them a step further. So, for example, one of the books that he cites in Murder, Most Foul is J. Epstein's Inquest. Now, I don't know if Stanley realized that Epstein would later become a turncoat, but in any case, in Inquest, Epstein mentions the fact that, several of the Warren commissioners pointedly said that, Alan Dulles said one of the principal tasks of the commission was to dispel rumors. McCloy said, America is not a banana republic where a government, makes me laugh to say this, can be changed by a conspiracy. And Epstein concludes that the implicit purpose of the commission was to protect the national interests by dispelling rumors. So Stanley grabs onto that phrase, and in Q&A number 46 in Murder, Most Foul, he rhetorically asks, what is meant by against the national interest? And he answers, the Warren Commission has never defined this undefinable phrase. However, after the publication of the Warren Report, many commentators and historians interpret that phrase to mean that whenever a future president is murdered, his killers can escape capture and punishment if a future investigating committee decides their capture would be against the national interest.
Bobby, do you have any insight, anything you'd like to bring out from the book that caught your eye?
I'm embarrassed to say this, but I have never ever sat down fully and read any of my father's books. Does that shock you?
I'm shocked. Come on, man.
It's not my area of expertise. I find a lot of my dad's writing very difficult to read.
Okay? I think somewhere it was a bit depressing for you.
Yes, and I grew up with this around the dinner table every single night. Politics and, you know, this was before the JFK, but, you know, Chicago was a big political city. My parents were involved in politics there. I grew up with all this stuff, and I was not really interested. You know, and that sounds terrible, and it probably is terrible, but it happens to be the truth. I have learned more about my dad's writing by reading Rob's essays than I could have by reading my father's books, which right. I find very difficult to read.
And you say, sitting around the dinner table, you heard it all firsthand before he decided to write.
Well, yeah, Mike, you know, that we didn't eat silent dinners. Everybody, it was mostly my dad talking and my mother and I listening. You know, and it was interesting, but I heard it. And a lot of it was, you know, I think my dad saw things as, you know, the glass as half empty. And so after you listen to, you know, you're sitting around the table and you listen to some stuff that's so depressing for 45 minutes, you can barely get up from the table afterwards. And I had a tendency as I grew older to just tune it out.
And Bobby, what would he say about tomorrow after all that gloom and doom? What would he say about tomorrow?
Well, then he would say something like, oh, but tomorrow the sun will be shining. But by this time you were so depressed, you didn't even know if the sun would ever come out again. It was just heavy. It was just heavy. And I was young and I really didn't care about that. The strange thing is, if my father were alive today, he probably would not recognize me, because I would say about 10 or 12 years ago, I suddenly became very, very interested in politics and now read current things. But when his books came out, I would skim over them and go, okay, and that was it. You know, so I think I was very disappointing as a daughter. You know, he couldn't talk to me about his books because I really, really had no interest in them.
You know, I want to just interject here that Bobby wrote me a very wonderful letter at the end of May, and she addressed some of this in the letter, and we put it in the reprint of Murder Most Foul. One of the things she says in the letter, she says, quote, "It is very apparent to me now how forward-looking my dad was. But much of what my dad said about the future was so depressing that I tuned him out. Who wants to hear this when you are in your 20s with your whole life in front of you? Now in my 70s, seeing what the world and especially America has become, it saddens me to say that he was right. In a way, I'm glad that he and my mother are no longer alive during these horrifying times with our totally corrupt government." That almost brings tears to my eyes. But I think that's very well said. And it's true. I mean, if you're a young person, life is in front of you, right? You need to engage in it. You can't second guess yourself.
Well, that happens often, where there's an old saying that you don't follow your parents' footsteps.
Yes, right.
It's like the shoemaker's kids go barefoot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but in this case, you're saying that now you have come full circle, that you really appreciate your father's writing and you have got an interest in this. And, you know, it's such a dark topic, too. It's political research. It isn't looking for the good that people have done. It's kind of revealing just what the hell have you guys been doing? We left you in charge and look at the mess now.
That's exactly it. And I'm seeing the interesting thing about it now, Len, is that I'm seeing my father through other people's eyes. You know, like, you know, Rob sees him as a certain kind of person. You said you've been blown away by his, you know, by the book. Rob has shared what other people have said, and I'm ecstatic about it. I mean, I'm so thrilled that my father is being recognized again. That's all through Rob's work. It's wonderful, and at some point, I probably will sit down and try and look at these things a little bit more carefully, but at the time they were written, I'm sorry to say, I really had no interest in them.
And Len, if I could interject here, you know, talking like Bobby's talking about how meaningful it's been for her to hear what other people, how other people react so enthusiastically to Stan's writing. You know, I've been in touch with someone who's become a very close friend, Al Rossi, who used to be the webmaster and editor with Jim DiEugenio at Kennedy's and King. He just wrote me a very interesting letter about Murder Most Foul, which he just finished reading. And if I could quote from that, he said, you know, there are elements in his approach, which today would probably be considered a bit obsolete because later information has emerged. But for 1967, it was extremely insightful and compendious as well, and can serve as a very useful summary of what is generally a defensible position. He serves up a potent dish. And I love the way he addresses what he calls the rape of the American conscience, mainly to Alan Dulles, not to Earl Warren, end of quote, because Stanley knew that Warren was merely the nominal head of the commission, but the real power was Dulles. He knew that in 1967. And Al Rossi adds this. He says, I think Marx's real prescience has to do with the larger issues, not the well-known facts of the case that his analysis shares with Mark Lane, Sylvia Beer, and others. One big item is his prediction of what would happen to Jim Garrison, because Marx predicted that they would either kill him physically or destroy his reputation. But then, you know, Al adds that, okay, there's the big picture, but even on some of the particulars, Marx was also very innovative, because he says, how about his non-belief in the Oswald route? And his belief in the veracity of Sheriff Roger Craig's story, who saw Oswald get into the Rambler, or the idea that the assassination was part of a larger intended false flag operation to start a war with Cuba and or Russia, and who else was questioning the Warren Commission's version of the Zapruder camera speed in 1967. Not that I necessarily agree here, but that position was very daring for its time. So, you know, it's very important to Bobby, but also to me, I mean, that these other people like you, Len, who were so deeply versed in the case, Jim DiEugenio, have also responded so enthusiastically. Jim just posted a note on Facebook the other day, which I don't think you've heard yet, Bobby, but he said, Stanley Marx was way ahead of the field. While people like Harold Weisberg and Hosiah Thompson were still counting bullets, he was calling JFK's death a coup d'etat. That is the perspective he wrote from way back in the late 60s. Don't pass up the chance to meet with a prophet. Read both of these books. You will be shocked by the insight in them. We've also heard from lesser-known people who have emailed us.
Well, if I can interrupt before, hold that thought. It just his analysis of Alan Dulles in this book is so right on. I mean, you really get the idea that because of his, and I'm speculating here, because of his writing on military tactics earlier, that he recognizes military tactics here.
That's an excellent point, Len. I'm glad you brought that up. And in all of these early books, he also talks about the assassination attempts, the numerous assassination attempts against France's President Charles de Gaulle. He's also talking about Permandex and how Clay Shaw could not feign ignorance because he was part of that organization. So, I mean, he really kept up with all the information that was going on out there. You want to say more about the Dulles thing? I think that's
well. I just wanted to mention that when I tried to to whittle down with what I, me and Jeff Carter took a year to make 50 reasons for 50 years on the 2013, the 50th anniversary. I thought we'll just take the main points. Now, you think of the 975 of in this book. If you were to just cut it in half, you say, well, everyone can't be so important. Cut it in half and you're around 500. He has 500 points of that. If I used the word pummeling earlier, if I was talking to you, that's what it's like. Mm. It's like, so when you get the book and you get into some of these rhetorical questions about, well, why doesn't Alan Dulles ask this? Or how does he go into executive session? Or how does he... The whole thing is obvious. And what is astounding is that this happened in 1965, 66, because the book is published in 67. You didn't write it in a day, right? So he pondered this right after. And he's mentioning that one of the days of the infamy is the day of the Warren Report, the Warren Commission, coming out with this little fairy tale to insult the American public.
Yeah, it's just astounding. It's just astounding.
I don't want to talk about Trump, but I keep thinking of so many things, Bill Barr, and so many things. There's so many came out, the press secretaries, and they blatantly said, well, this is an alternative fact, right? I mean, you think, am I talking to a little kid or is this an adult? And we just went through 3.5 years, 4 years of this daily. I mean, it's like Bobby was saying, probably his head would explode having to listen to this crap,
Right.
You're right on that one.
And so I could see that where I would be interested in 9/11, the 9/11 Commission, and tearing that apart would be a scholarly effort. This latest stuff is just to the next level. And unfortunately, there's... I get letters. There's people who are fans of Trump that are fans of this show. They still have the same interest, they just, there was, when the election results were announced, there was bells ringing in cities around the world. Can you think of that?
I mean,
you just go, thank God. People are going, are you kidding? I mean, many people have said, how the hell did Hitler get elected? How did he get through that? And now you go, I can see how it happens. There's torches in the streets. And then yikes. But anyway, that's why I hate to mention Trump and get into that thing. But it's the same thing. If you were thinking about, well, Dulles and the commission, what the hell, how can they just print this? And like he said, well, the American public doesn't read. Don't worry. We're just putting something together. And then the day after, every news, I mean, unfortunately, you want to say fake news. All the media all got together and said, well, there it is. Lee Oswald did it. And everybody go back to sleep.
Yes.
And then they belittle. They go out of their way to attack anybody who critiques it. And then further, you find that Jim Garrison's office is bugged. You talked about the university people writing in to just have a disinformation campaign. The Big Red Square. These guys are nothing but commies. They have no idea what... ask them to define the word communism or socialism, right? Do you have a fire department? Do you have a department of highways, transport? I mean, start thinking about what that means. You want to help your community.
Yeah, that would be a government that cared more about its citizens than about big business and the economic oligarchy. We can keep dreaming on about that,
Well, it's almost unfathomable to think of the money that has been wasted on this effort to... What did you say earlier about, or maybe you're quoting him, keeping the national interest going?
Right.
Just what is the national interest and how much money has been spent to prop up that facade I don't want to get too sidetracked, but you remember in the Iraq War, they said, oh, the war will pay for itself kind of thing. Right? What the hell? Do you think that oil's coming here? It's going to Europe.
Right. And let me add that in Murder, Most Foul from 1967, he's already talking about economic interests, well before other people did later on. He's following the money trail as well. And he continues to do that through all four assassination books.
It's such an educated opinion. That's what that really
it is.
Hit it for me.
Right.
It's not like a guy just saying, you know, I think there's something wrong here, and how do you explain this? He gives you, like you were calling, a rhetorical question where you kind of go, well, you're right, how can I believe that? And then he answers it for you, right?
Right.
I know you mentioned it was kind of like a lawyer's brief or something. I didn't get that. I felt like it was somebody just explaining to me mm-hmm. what was wrong about it.
Right, right. And you know, it's really an interesting question, which we'll never know the answer to. But I've often wondered about what led Stanley to publish all this work on the assassinations. You know, did this kind of research just naturally suit him and his temperament? And after all, he was a lawyer. He was a leading figure in a debaters forum that was composed of university alumni in Chicago that was broadcast on the radio. And, you know, Bobby mentioned that he was an avid reader of detective stories. But when I read Murder Most Foul and also 2 Days of Infamy, I think one of the things that may have really provided a great creative spark was the anger and indignation that resulted in reading an article, and Stanley's reading an article written by Fletcher Nebel, which was published in Look magazine in July 1966. The last word of the article is a quote that Look magazine received from Alan Dulles, which is a pointed attack against the Warren Commission critics. And Dulles says, quote, and Stanley cites this in both these first two books, Dulles says, quote, if they found another assassin, let them name names and produce their evidence. And I really think it's quite possible that Murder Most Foul and 2 Days of Infamy was a direct response to this sort of tossing of the gauntlet. And because Stanley quotes him, and then he says basically, well, not only have I produced the evidence, I've shown that you were negligent in doing your job, you know?
Well, there's a little more to that. Did you have it in front of you? Because as I recall, it was something about Mr. Dulles, it is not our job to do this. It was your job to find
that. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It wasn't the citizen's job. You know, it was definitely your job.
Points out how he failed, you know?
Yes. Yes. And in 2 Days of Infamy, he continues that thought. I could quote right here from it. He quotes Dulles again, and then he says, the author has produced the evidence. It was the duty of Mr. Dulles and his commissioners to name the names of the assassins and the conspirators. That failure is theirs, not the responsibility of the American citizen. And then later on, he adds, history has proven that once assassination has become the weapon to change the government, that style and form of government preceding the assassination falls beneath the hard-nailed boots of the assassins. Both right and left favor no democratic spirit in the people. The cold of Siberia and the gas ovens of the concentration camps have proved it. The tragedy of the Warren Commission is that they helped set those boots on the road to the destruction of American democracy. Yeah. That's pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking that. So that's a guy telling you how it is. You know, it's an uncomfortable... the other book was called JFK and the Unspeakable. I mean, if you actually had someone lay it out, it's almost unspeakable to let people know what really went on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get with... his 975 items,
mm-hmm.
and some were longer than others. But even as I said, if you wanted to cut it in half, you're talking about 500.
I know.
And some of the ones where he picks apart Alan Dulles, I found most interesting and enjoyable that, you know, wow, he's getting right to the heart of it.
Yeah.
He's not saying around, does this bullet match or that bullet match or, you know, where'd the lead come from? You know what I mean?
Right. Like Jim said, he wasn't hanging around counting bullets, you know, like a lot of the others were, you know. And by the way, Len, you'll really enjoy 2 Days of Infamy because he continues to let Dulles have it. And the refrain that he uses in that book is he'll go off on a long thing, you know, showing why this stuff doesn't add up. And then at the end of the thing, he'll just say, "No conspiracy, Mr. Dulles," and then I'll go to the next one. And, you know, he'll end it again like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I haven't got that book yet, so that's, I mean, I'm still, you know, I've been going over this book. Just, you know, you read it once, you go, I've got to read it again because I should slow down. And now I'm getting it, be able to read between the lines. And the ironic thing is I already kind of thought I knew a lot about the topic, you know? And it's like, oh, yeah, right. I mean, there's some of these. Well, I don't want to go too much in detail right now, but we'll make links for the book.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, Link, are there one or two things that popped to mind that when you read it, you thought, wow, I've never heard of that before or never considered that before? Well, I think the other day you mentioned something about the rifles.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I hate to back out of my own question in a way, but there's just so many.
It's too much.
When you see that some of the affidavits and the guys were just 100% sure of the rifle they saw and the Mauser, right? And then there's, you know, witness after witness that I was unaware of. I thought there was one or two guys that mentioned Mauser, right? And then he says, well, what about this guy? What about, you know, like you say, the rhetorical question was, well, how many rifles were there that day? And, you know, you think there was only a Carcano. And then he answers that, well, here's what they found, you know, A, B, C, D, you know, just going on and on about, I don't have things in front of me, but, you know, just the paper of the, you know, the whole phony curtain rod thing and how big and the paper. And, you know, it just, I might have mentioned to you that I thought my 50 reasons was quite, you know, quite a feat. And this makes it look like child's play compared to what he did in 1967. And the book was published then, so what he did before that. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, like, we're looking forward to Oliver Stone's new documentary, 4-part series about, you know, the assassination, what we have learned now after the 57 years or whatever, right? And that's what you expect. Surprisingly, Stanley Marks has done this in 1967.
Right. And by the way,
it's not short. I mean, you know, I set it up so I listen to it. And, you know, people, I don't know if you can do this on ebooks or whatever, but I've got a voice reader on my cell phone. So I find that I'm always doing something or driving, whatever, and I can put on an audiobook and I just enjoy it like that. And, that's the thing that, you know, it's hours out, you know, it's not light reading. And that's why I've gone over 2 or 3 times. That's why when you said he's got 20 books, I go, this is the next year of my life just going through these.
Well, I think how I feel. I have to transcribe all of them. Huh?
Yeah. But, you know,
as a result of working on the transcription, I've actually read Murder Most Foul 5 times now, and I still can't remember everything that's in the damn book, you know?
Yeah. It is impressive. And
Len, can I read this letter that we got from
an
old fan of Stan Marks? So after Jim published the first piece about Dylan's Murder Most Foul, in which he mentioned the research I was doing on Stanley's Murder Most Foul, He got an email, which he forwarded to me from a gentleman named Nick Anez. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, A-N-E-Z. And Nick says, "Jim DiEugenio has asked me to inform you of a book I have. The title is Yes, Americans, A Conspiracy Murdered JFK by Stanley J. Marks and Ethel M. Marks." And so I wrote back to Nick. This was, by the way, in mid-May, and asked him for more info. And he said, "I purchased the book at an assassination symposium on John Kennedy conference in Dallas in 1993. By the way, that book came out in 92. I subsequently read the book, and I recall thinking that it was one of the best books on the JFK assassination. I wish I could be more specific, but I would have to reread it to give you a more detailed analysis of why the book affected me emotionally and intellectually. I also recall that I tried to contact Mr. Marks and his wife to express my appreciation and to ask how I could purchase their other books on the subject, but I can't recall if I received an answer. And this shows you how far back in time this goes, because he says, however, my memory is hazy, and lately I can't remember what I did yesterday. So I think a lot of these fans are from our generation. And then subsequently, and I was very touched by this, he read the big article that I published at K&K about Stanley's life. And he wrote, "I cannot say enough good things about your article, which I intend to read again and again. It answers so many questions about Stanley Marks that I've wondered about for so many years. You are so right to point out how ahead of the curve he was, not only regarding his insight into the JFK assassination, but into the connection between all three murders. I hope that your piece brings him the belated recognition and praise he did not receive during his lifetime. He should not be relegated to obscurity, for he was a true pioneer in the field of assassination research. Your biography also makes me admire him even more. I truly wish that I had continued to try to contact him instead of giving up. I regret that I could not have written him a letter of appreciation. Thanks so much, and for this wonderful tribute." And he asked me also to forward the letter to Bobby. Bobby, what's it make you feel like to see your father have all this posthumous recognition?
Well, I'm obviously thrilled, and this man's letter is very touching to me, because I sense so much truthfulness in it, you know, that he really wanted to reach my father. My father would have loved talking to him. So on the level of, you know, his getting the recognition now, I'm thrilled. And on the other level, I'm so saddened because he's not here to see it.
Right.
You know, he's not here to see it. My father would have loved it. Anyone who would have contacted him, he would have picked up the phone and he would have spent hours on the phone talking to them. Mm-hmm. He would have loved it. And so it's wonderful. It's wonderful for me, but I would have liked my father to have gotten this recognition.
Yeah.
And so on that level, I'm very sad.
But, you know, Len, Bobby and I have also talked about, well, what would have happened if he was as well known as Mark Lane, who was followed 24/7 by the FBI and probably the CIA, and who claimed that there was an attempt on his life by the CIA. I also know that Gerald McKnight, who wrote an amazing book about the Warren Commission, Breach of Trust, he includes in the appendix there a memo, an internal memo in the FBI, in which Hoover basically told his agents to open up fake sex dossiers on all the critics, you know, to gather dirt on them. So it's like a mixed bag if he had gotten that recognition. I remember in Sylvia Meir.
Can you think about that for a minute? Can you imagine the poverty of that? That's the head of the FBI, right?
With our taxpayer dollars.
Yeah.
Right.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, really. I have to put my two cents in. As Rob has said, we've discussed this before. And when I see what happened to, you know, to other people, in a way, I guess I'm glad that my father didn't get the recognition, because I can't imagine what life would be like being followed by the FBI and the CIA and all the other dirt that they would throw at you. Not a very pleasant thought.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, at least you can say this, that better late than never, that people are recognizing that your father was a great writer, and it's an intellectual journey as well. That's the thing that I could relate to then, as you mentioned that not only did he point out facts, but he did it that it made me think that, you know, how could I miss this? He's laid it in front of me so well. And you know, to top it off, it started from the Bob Dylan song, where Bob Dylan very eloquently did that in his lines of poetry lyric. To do that, you go, oh my God, of course, you know. And it's
so we have to thank Bob Dylan,
right? That for being a catalyst to have people say.
I did send the official Bob Dylan website an email about Murder Most Foul, and I did notice an upspike in sales after that. So we can only hope for the best.
Right.
You know.
Where is the book available right now?
Well, thanks for asking. Yeah, so it's available all over the place. If you go to the Kennedys and King website and you click on my latest article, which Jim titled The Prophecies of Stanley J. Marks, which I love that title. At the end of the piece, there's a link. There's two links, one for Murder Most Foul, one for 2 Days of Infamy. It's available on Amazon internationally, Amazon USA, France, Germany, Spain, also on Barnes & Noble. And if you go to bookfinder.com, you'll find over 20 links to places to buy it. And,
okay, I'll make links to that.
People buying it.
Yeah, yeah, very good. And I think people will be interested in just hearing from his daughter and you for being the catalyst to organizing this. Because if you, you know, if you're lucky to get some, what was that book that the fella, well, it was written by Stanley and his wife as well. You're saying it was they co-authored?
Bobby, you want to answer that?
Well, my father was the one who did the main writing, and my mother was his proofreader and, quote, editor.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but he gave her credit for it because he was, you know, all his ideas were bounced off of her.
Right.
So she got the credit for it, but she really didn't contribute to any of the research or the writing. That was strictly Stanley J. Marks.
Right. No, I was just reflecting back to what you'd said there, Rob, that there was a book you hadn't heard of, that this, you got a letter from the guy you just read the letter. So this was an unknown book?
No, I actually, he had written Jim saying he had one of Stanley's books, so Jim suggested he contact me.
Right.
I already had that book. That's the fourth JFK assassination book. Yes, Americans, a Conspiracy Murdered John F. Kennedy.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear that title.
Published later. That one was, you know, most of these books were between 1967, the second was 69. And then coup d'etat was 1970, but this one was in 1992. So I think Stanley was like something like 77 years old or something like that when he put that out. And, you know, it shows he was still keeping at it. You know, he was still keeping in touch with all the latest information. I'm glad you brought this up because this was the early 90s. So I thought, well, you know, this is an important year, 1992, because you have the assassination record and review board, and, you know, as the result of the Oliver Stone film, there was legislation to release the files. Suddenly we've got millions of files being released, millions of pages of files. And then we've got the internet by the late 90s. So I asked Bobby recently, well, you know, did your dad ever use the internet or word processor or anything? And Bobby has a very funny story about that. You want to talk about that, Bobby?
My dad was he knew how to turn on. It was a word processing thing. He went out and he bought it because he knew everybody had the internet. He wanted to be up to speed on things. So he went without anyone's knowledge. And my husband is fairly decent with the computer, so he went on his own and he bought a word processor and drove. I gave up, but really my husband is a very patient man, drove my husband absolutely crazy. He spent I don't know how many days trying to, beyond the fact that my dad knew how to turn the on and off button on the machine, trying to explain to him how to use this word processor. And he didn't understand why it wouldn't print. Well, it wouldn't print because my dad didn't buy the printer to go with it. My dad just did not understand anything mechanical. So my husband spent, I think, 2 to 3 weeks on weekends trying to show him how to use this machine and couldn't get anywhere with him. And finally, my dad went and returned it and went back to his two-finger typing, which I think he was very happy with anyway.
Well, you had mentioned to me, I think maybe on the phone, or I'm not sure, Rob, that you had found a letter that he had written to Oliver Stone after 1992.
Yes. So in that book, Yes, Americans, he starts off with a copy of the letter that he wrote to Oliver Stone. And so we know from that he actually saw Oliver's movie. And he also wrote a letter to, Manchester, the guy that wrote one of the early books about
William Manchester.
Right. Who believed in the Warren Commission and the idea that Oswald did it all. And, Stanley writes this letter that's trying to straighten him out. And he reproduces that also at the beginning of the book, So recently I bought a copy of Oliver's film, CD, and sent it to Bobby. So Bobby's, that's next on her plate. She's going to see Oliver's Stone for the first, Oliver's movie for the first time.
Well, there's so many books, and I feel so much wisdom ahead of me to pick up from Stanley Mark. So it's a great luxury that it's not lost and or wasn't burnt. And you remember in the early Germany, the book burnings they had. I mean, absolutely incredible. I can't even fathom that. That's their answer, to burn.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And in America, we produce lots of diversion so that people aren't even interested in books. It's like the dollhouse version of burning books, It's another problem.
Well, it doesn't have to be a book, because I think, with a podcast or guys like Joe Rogan or, other people, like, I can turn on a computer and listen or watch without actually reading a book. And so we can gather knowledge. But knowledge and wisdom, because it's kind of one thing to just have this collection of data. And then the second thing is you analyze it and draw conclusions from it, as opposed to just saying, we know there was 5 shots, there was 3 shots or whatever, hey, there were shots and they couldn't have come from that rifle. So it doesn't really matter how many bullets they're saying, nobody could shoot that rifle. Right.
Yeah. And, I'm glad you bring that up, Len, because, one of the questions you asked me before about, Stanley's knowledge about military history must have given him an edge, certainly on many of the other early researchers. And, not only is that true, but you got to keep in mind that Stanley had accumulated in his late 20s, by the time he was writing The Bear That Walks Like a Man, he had accumulated a 5,000-book personal library. I mean, that is mind-blowing. A 5,000-book library, mostly on politics and history. He had such a wealth of knowledge to draw from. And as you said, he knew to look at the archetypal patterns, the eternally reoccurring patterns of human behavior, specifically in a military, political, and clandestine context. He knew about agent provocateurs. He knew about how conspiracy operations work. And so the idea that JFK would have been killed as a result of a conspiracy was not the last idea that he came to after counting bullets. It was the first question in his mind.
Well, it's a tactic. Right. And when you think there's always a patsy, when you think about James Earl Ray, Martin and Sirhan, right? I mean, and you just, I haven't had time to look into this, but I'm even skeptical of that David Chapman, Mark David Chapman.
I completely agree with
you. It's just, but I hate to jump to conclusions, but I just think there's something wrong there.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Who shoots somebody and then sits down in a book and starts on the curb and starts reading this book, right?
By the way, there's a very good book called Drugs as Weapons Against Us.
Yeah.
And that's got one of the best things I've read about why John Lennon's assassin was probably a patsy. I would recommend that to people. Have you seen that title, Len?
It's been brought to my attention several times. I just don't have the time.
Yeah, who's got the time?
Well, I'm not making an excuse in a way. It's just that, for instance, I generally have to read a book a week or so, or two a month, in order to conduct an interview and have an interest in it. And then it's a book you like. You read it twice. You're going, I'm listening it to right up into our showtime right today. You know, I'm still going over things because
sure.
And then I'm digesting it. If it was like a comic book, you'd read it and you'd get it. But then you sit back and you go, well, geez, I never thought of it from that point of view. And, you know, I've got to look more into this. And geez, this guy's right. You know, that's what I'm getting from, you know, Stanley Moore. And then I think your second book, I may have gotten it from you in email, but I haven't had time to open it. And then you've got a list of about 19 or 20 books that all seem important. And,
yeah, and you know, the second book is really interesting. I'll just quickly say this, Lynn. The second book is really an interesting comparison to the first one, because besides the fact that he's also talking about RFK and Martin Luther King, you know, the Murder Most Foul can also, like Bobby said before, it can be a bit jarring because it's like a pummeling, like you said, one question and answer after the other for 979 questions and answers. But, and so that you know, as a writer, that's a difficult thing to do, you know, to show the reader that you have the ability to write lyrically when constant interruptions, okay? But with 2 Days of Infamy, I realized what a good writer this man was. And particularly when I cleaned up a bit of the punctuation and grammar, because he didn't have the benefit of a good editor, I told Bobby it was almost like an archaeologist exhuming a dinosaur skeleton, and when you dust it off, you see the beautiful articulation of the spine emerge from the dust. This guy, like any good writer, had a wonderful sense of rhythm, and there's a melody line in his text, and it's really an enthralling piece of writing. I think it may be, of the four books, the most well-written one, 2 Days of Infamy. It's a gorgeous read. It's a gorgeous piece of writing. And there are some excerpts from that book in the new piece I just published, The Kennedys and King.
All right. Well, it looks like we're going to be speaking to you and possibly Bobby again, because there's just such an archive to go through. And it seems to be very interesting intellectually as well. You know, just not murder mystery, but trying to make the world a better place by understanding what's going on.
Well, I really appreciate, and I know Bobby really appreciates as well, I think, you know, the fact that you're giving us this time and this venue. And, you know, last night I was thinking, what would Stanley Marks think about Black Op Radio? I mean, he would probably be your most devoted subscriber. And also, I want to, in that context, I want to give a shout out to everyone listening here. Len is doing this show on a shoestring. Please support him and subscribe. It's only $4 a month for 4 amazing interviews. And, you know, it's better than anything you're going to get on MSNBC or CNN, for sure. And we can guarantee that Len is not a sheep dip agent.
Before we go, I'd like to add my 2 cents to this. Len, thank you very much for allowing me to be part of your show. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your kindness. And a heartfelt thanks to Rob Couteau, who I believe has resurrected my father from the dead. None of this could have been done without Rob. He is a great researcher. He's a great writer. He's become a great friend. And he's made my dad come alive again. What else could you ask for? Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby.
Yeah, well, thank you, Rob. And it's good that, you know, you find something that accidentally you work your way into, but it's worthwhile. And this is, these books, the first one I've read is so worthwhile. It's just, it's staggering. Mm-hmm. Like I said, when I'm, you know, I must have been doing the show for years, 2013, you know, with the 50th anniversary, and I thought I knew enough to keep, you know, do a good show on the 50 reasons for 50 years, and this just eclipses it. I mean, I don't know, other knocks it out of the ballpark. I mean, it's just, you're just kind of in awe. You think, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this book is a must read, and I just highly recommend it. And, you know, at least on the show here with Jim DiEugenio, we try to recommend things that are worthwhile. And there are these other books and documentaries that come out that are not worthwhile. And somehow they gain popularity or some momentum by getting these reviews that rave about them. But I don't think anyone will be sorry for, you know, you watch the movie JFK, you read On the Trail of the Assassins, JFK the Unspeakable, something by Mark Lane, anything by Jim DiEugenio. You read and you learn, and then, wow, we're standing on the shoulders of giants with Stanley Marks.
Mm. Well said, Len. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, I guess we'll wrap it up. Just before I go, I often offer, is there anything that you wanted to bring up that we didn't get to?
I think we're good. Bobby, was there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think I'm good. I just wanted to thank both of you. It was really a joy and a pleasure to be on this show with both of you. So thank you again.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. We'll talk again, I hope.
Thanks, Len. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
Okay. Good night.